Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have two cases set for oral submission on the 130 docket, and then we have one case set for oral submission on the 3 o'clock docket. The remaining cases are set for submission on briefs. Your panel is to my right, Justice Sue Walker. To my left, Justice Bill Meyer. I'm Leanne Dofino. And did the lawyers for the second case get here yet? Okay. Well, we were waiting for the second lawyer in the second case to get here, but he'll have a little time yet, so we'll go ahead and get started. I understand both sides are ready? Okay. All right, if you call the case, we'll get started.
The court will now call Aero 18 versus Dennis Markman and Jerry K. Baker. May it please the court, Mr. Joshua P. Martin will argue for the appellant. Ms. Paula K. Canepa will argue for the appellee.
All right. Joshua, you ready?
May it please the court, my name is Joshua Martin and I represent the appellant Aero AT. I'd like to talk first just briefly about the issue of jurisdiction. And this court absolutely has jurisdiction over this appeal. And this court has previously determined that this can proceed as a restricted appeal as opposed to a direct appeal. Appellees challenge that. Their only argument is that appellant's filing, of a post-judgment special appearance constitutes a post-judgment motion for the purposes of the ability to proceed under Rule of Appellate Procedure 30. Now, appellees cite no authority in support of this proposition. They cite two cases that stand for the non-controversial and frankly irrelevant proposition that a non-resident defendant who's subject to a default judgment who wishes to challenge that default judgment must first file a post-judgment special appearance prior to filing, a motion for new trial. That is true as far as it goes, but it has nothing to do with whether or not a post-judgment special appearance constitutes a post-judgment motion for the purposes of proceeding under Rule 30. For that reason,
why wouldn't it?
Well, the rule behind the no post-judgment motion rule, or a better way to put it, is to qualify as a post-judgment motion for the purposes of Rule 30. The post-judgment filing, whatever it is, must extend the deadline for the appellant to file a notice of direct appeal. The rationale there is if you have extra time to file a notice of direct appeal, you're not entitled to the benefit of the additional time that's available under a restricted appeal. So for appellees to be correct, it must be the case that a post-judgment special appearance extends the deadline to file a direct appeal. And there's nothing in Rule of Appellate Procedure 26.1A that supports that. And appellees have cited no authority that indicates that that's the case. And to the best of appellant's knowledge, there is no authority that says that supports their proposition.
And there's no authority to the contrary either, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. There's no case law authority, but just looking at Rule 26.1A and its list of filings that extend the notice of appeal, direct appeal deadline, there is no indication that a post-judgment special appearance falls within that category.
But I'm just wondering from a policy standpoint, why wouldn't it? Because it's basically requesting dismissal of the case for want of jurisdiction. So it's requesting something similar, if not better, than what a motion for a new trial would be requesting. And if you said it didn't extend the appellate timetable, then really the filing of it is a nullity because the timetable is going to expire the next day in this case. So just from a policy standpoint, why shouldn't we say that it constitutes a post-judgment motion that extends the appellate timetable?
Sure. It's a good question, Your Honor. And what it comes down to is, again, the rationale, which is articulated in a 2004 decision from this court. It's not in our brief, but I do have the citation, and I can give it to the clerk when we're finished. But the question in that case was, did a certain type of post-judgment submission extend the appellate deadline, and therefore was it a post-judgment motion for the purposes of Rule 30? And this court held that under those circumstances, it was, if I recall correctly, a motion for extension of time to file motion to reinstate. That was the filing at issue. And this court said if it doesn't extend the appellate deadline, such as a notice of appeal deadline, then it doesn't count as a post-judgment motion under Rule 30. I mean, I see your policy point, but I think what the rationale that's been articulated is if it extends the appellate timetable, then it's a post-judgment motion for the purpose of Rule 30. If it doesn't, it's not. With respect to appellant's issues.
Martin, before you leave that subject.
Yes, Your Honor.
If what you just said is the position of your client, why did you file a special appearance?
Well, Your Honor, it's a good question. The special post-judgment special appearance was filed within, I want to say, less than 48 hours after appellant's counsel had been retained in this matter. And a decision was made that that was the appropriate preparatory step to filing a motion for new trial, which it would have been. Unfortunately, there just was not sufficient time for that motion for new trial to be filed. Otherwise, we would be proceeding as a direct appeal after filing a motion for new trial.
Okay.
Kind of a belt and suspenders approach, Your Honor.
That's okay. Whatever it is, it is.
With respect to appellant's issues 1 through 3 and 5, these are based on a very simple premise, and that is that the record evidences that the trial court committed reversible error by entering a no-answer partial default judgments and later final default judgments without notice to appellant. And it's error because the appellant had filed what's referred to as the foreign document with the trial court, and that document was sufficient to constitute an answer that would preclude default judgment under, among many other cases, the Supreme Court's, Texas Supreme Court's 1992 decision in Smith versus Lippman. And I think it's important to note here that there's very little in dispute with respect to the parties' positions here. Appellees concede that the trial court had an independent obligation to examine the record and determine if an answer was on file before issuing default judgment. Appellees concede that the trial court did in fact review the record, which would have included the foreign document, prior to entering default judgment. Appellees concede that the trial court nonetheless concluded that no answer was on file. And appellees concede that it's reversible error for a trial court to enter default judgment when an answer is on file, a no-answer default judgment when an answer is on file. And in fact, appellees don't even contest that the foreign document at issue here met the Lippman test for an answer sufficient to preclude default judgment. And appellees' argument here instead is, well, if that's error, it's inferential error. It's not error evident on the face of the record. But that's just simply incorrect, because the record reflects that the trial court reviewed that foreign document and concluded that it was not an answer. Now, that foreign document met the standard for an answer articulated in the Lippman decision, which is very straightforward. If a document, a filing, constitutes an answer sufficient to preclude default judgment, if it's in a writing signed by the party, if it has the defendant's address, if it identifies the parties and identifies the case, that's all that matters. Because the test there is not whether it is a procedurally proper answer, but whether if it is a writing that evidences the defendant's acknowledgement that a suit has been filed against him. That's really the test is here. So we have in the record the foreign document, which is a writing signed by the appellant. It identifies the parties, it identifies the case by cause number, and it includes the appellant's address, the same address that citation was sent to. And those four factors alone are sufficient to satisfy Lippman. But we have one more. That foreign document, it's a letter written in Polish. It attaches to it a report in English from the National Transportation Safety Board. That's a report on the plane crash that gave rise to plaintiff's lawsuit. So if you look at all those things together, it is very clear that that document is an answer under the Lippman test. It's acknowledging appellant's receipt of the lawsuit against it, and that's all that's required. Appellee's secondary argument is that statements made by the appellant in their post-judgment special appearance indicate that that, in fact, was not an answer. And appellees are wrong there for at least three reasons. First, the question of whether or not the foreign document met the test for an answer is a question of law, first for the trial court and now for this court. No statement by a party about the effect of that document can be dispositive of the court's independent exercise of answering that legal question. Second, this is a restricted appeal, and a restricted appeal is limited to the face of the record. And the face of the record is defined as those documents that are on file with the trial court at the time judgment is rendered. In this case, when the trial court made its erroneous determination that no answer had been on file, the only document in front of it was the foreign document. The trial court could not have been influenced by a statement made in a post-judgment special appearance that was filed 18 months later. It's just, it can't, for temporal common sense, it can't happen. And three, as I indicated in a question from Justice Meyer, answer to a question from Justice Meyer earlier, that post-judgment special appearance was filed less than 48 hours after appellant's counsel was retained. It reflected appellant's counsel's understanding of the record at that time. That understanding, to the extent the special appearance can be construed as saying no document sufficient to preclude entry of default judgment was on file, was incorrect, and we freely acknowledge that. But the position that's been taken in this appeal, it is now and it has always been that the foreign document was sufficient to constitute an answer. With respect to the final issue, issue number four, this has to do with the entry of final judgment. Trial court committed reversible error by entering final judgment on unliquidated damages without receiving evidence of the appellee's damages. Now, there were two final judgments issued in this case, which are identical, and they both say that trial of this matter was held on June 30, 2014. They both say that the judgments were entered after the trial court received evidence of damages. But looking at the face of the record, there's no indication of any kind that a trial took place in this matter. There's no order setting trial, there's no notice setting trial, there are no pretrial filings. But more importantly, there's no evidence in the record that was submitted on the issue of damages. So the trial court appears to have reached, at least based on the face of the record, a completely unsupported conclusion that there were evidence of damages. Now, appellee's argument here, as I understand it, is that trial was held. It was just held, if I can back up slightly, this case was originally filed as part of a larger matter. After default judgment was entered, it was severed into this matter at plaintiff's request. If I understand appellee's argument, it is that the trial was held in the original matter, the earlier filed matter, and evidence submitted in that matter led to the trial court's conclusion in this matter. There's no support in the record for that argument, and I understand appellees have made it, but there's nothing to indicate that that's actually the case. With respect to appellee's request to supplement, they said, the court should allow us to supplement the record to include this evidence of damages that was submitted in the other matter. And we haven't seen a formal motion, so it's difficult for me to evaluate it now, but my threshold response to that is that should be rejected, for the simple reason that this is a restricted appeal. And again, as a restricted appeal, the decision it has to be made on the face of the record at the time judgment was entered. And the record at the time judgment was entered through today indicates that no trial on damages took place. So if appellee is allowed to selectively alter the record to bring that in, I think that creates huge problems. It makes this something other than a restricted appeal, and it would be prejudicial to appellant. By way of just limited example, in that earlier matter, two final judgments were issued in that matter against my client, the appellant. Identical two final judgments were issued in this matter. So if this were a non-restricted appeal, a direct appeal, we would have an argument that those judgments are duplicative and they're based on the same facts, the same causes of action, so two of them have to go away. We can't make that argument now because this is a restricted appeal and we're limited to the face of the record we have here. If appellee is entitled to bring into this record evidence from the earlier filed matter, then we should be allowed to bring in evidence of what that trial on damage resulted in, which are duplicative final judgments. But then again, we end up in a situation where this is no longer a restricted appeal. It's something else. And I think that—
couldn't the trial court take judicial notice of its file?
I agree that the trial court could take judicial notice of its file, but there's no indication in the record that that's what happened here. And I think more significantly, there is no evidence in the record of plaintiff's damages, appellee's damages. So that puts us in a situation where, if that's not in the record, it is impossible for us to challenge on a restricted appeal or even a direct appeal the sufficiency of the evidence. That concludes my argument.
Mr. Martin,
Yes, sir.
What evidence is there in the record that Judge Fosdale didn't understand and read this document that's called a foreign document and understand it, even though it's in the Polish language? Do we know if Judge Fosdale is fluent in the Polish language?
We don't know, Your Honor, if he's fluent in the Polish language. What the record reflects is that in the partial default judgment that was issued on January 22nd of 2013, Judge Fosdale says, I've reviewed the papers. I'm paraphrasing here, Your Honor.
Yes.
I've reviewed the papers and pleadings on file in this case, and there is no answer on file. So taking Judge Fosdale at his word that he reviewed the foreign document, he reached an erroneous conclusion because the face of the document by itself meets the Lippmann standard. You don't have to speak. I don't speak any Polish, Your Honor, and I can look at it and
I can
see.
You don't know what it says either then, do you?
but I can see that for the four very basic pieces of information that the Texas Supreme Court requires are there.
I understand your argument, and I just was curious as to whether you as and your firm as representing this party ever translated the exact language that's in this document so that it's somewhere available in terms of a transcription of what is actually the what would be a transcription of this Polish language document into English.
Sure, and it's a good question, Your Honor. We do not have a certified formal translation, and I've seen an informal translation. Unfortunately, it's not in the record, so I can't refer the court to
okay.
it.
Okay, well, I just wondered if that had ever happened or what happened about that in the process of this procedure.
Sure, Your Honor, and what we did is, obviously, we want to know what it says. For obvious reasons, but because this is a restricted appeal, we're limited to what's in the record, and at the time judgment was entered in front of the trial court, final judgment, there wasn't a translated version.
All right. Thank you for your presentation.
You're welcome.
There is a rule of law that when a litigant does not speak English, an involuntary litigant, someone who's facing criminal charges or termination or a litigant, and they are indigent and do not have a translator, they are considered not to be present because, and presumably someone who's deaf, who's not provided a translator, would not be present. So if you have a document in a foreign language that is not translated, how can that document be present?
It's a good question, Your Honor, and I think that depending on the circumstances, it might very well be the case that a document in foreign language is the equivalent of not being present. But going back to the fundamental principle present in Lippmann and countless other cases is that Texas courts will do everything they can to refuse to uphold a default judgment if some indication in the record is on file that the defendant understood that it had been sued. And the foreign document, again, the face of it meets the Lippmann test, but the English language attachment to it, which is the NTSB's report on this plane crash, those elements all combined should have suggested to the trial court that, yes, absolutely, the appellant understood that that it has been sued, and it is filing this document in response to that suit, because there would be no other explanation for why the document was filed other than in response to the lawsuit.
And if a document that's filed concedes every element of the lawsuit against it?
Yes, Your Honor, that is the equivalent of an answer sufficient to prevent default judgment, and I apologize, I do
or
not
or does not address anything in the
In the
pleadings?
Sure. That's a difficult question to answer, but in Lippmann, the letter that was sent in that the Supreme Court found to be sufficient to constitute an answer was, paraphrasing from memory, I've received a copy of the citation against me. That was it. There was no denial. There was no concession of liability. There was nothing. Just, I have received it. And so from that comes this test that's played out in some of the other cases that we've cited on this point, that all that matters is that the submission acknowledge that a lawsuit has been filed against the defendant.
And the fact that the cause number and the parties was in a was present on the pleading and had no need to be translated because they're the same, you think that that then makes it a pleading?
It makes it an answer sufficient to preclude the entry of default judgment. I want to be careful in my phrasing.
Right.
But your point is it's correct. All you have to do is look at the page of the document. It's at the appellate record at 34 is the first page. In the upper right-hand corner is it identifies the court, has the correct address information. On the left, it has the identifies the plaintiffs, it identifies the appellant and its address, and it has a cause number in the ray line. And clearly the court understood it to be something submitted in the lawsuit because it was docketed in the lawsuit. And so I think under that bare test articulated in Lippman, this document satisfies it.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Your Honor. I only can wonder if while we're making assumptions about the document, isn't it just a matter of whether the glass is half full or half empty, whether we consider this document being one that is in opposition to the plaintiff's petition or one that may be confessing judgment?
Well, that's a good question, Your Honor. And there is a case, and I apologize, I may not have the citation immediately in front of me, where the document that was submitted by a pro se defendant acknowledged liability and said, we are simply trying to work out payment. We have an agreement on a payment plan. We've been trying to get a hold of the plaintiff. We haven't heard back from him. Even that is sufficient to preclude the entry of default judgment.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Before we go any further, they are repairing sprinkler heads on the fourth floor, and there is a possibility that we will have a false fire alarm. So if there is a false fire alarm, unless someone calls us and tells us it's not false, we'll just stay here, but we'll stop the time if someone's speaking and start it again after the alarm's over. You will not be expected to continue to speak during the alarm.
Did you just give
them that? Yes.
That's for you, Ms. Canepa.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, I'm very glad that the court warned me of that. I might have thought it was personal to me. May it please the court? I have several points on overview before I address specifically counsel's arguments. I think the first one is a policy decision that needs to be made by the court, which is what kind of burdens are we going to impose on a trial court? Are we going to require it to receive documents that are written in a completely foreign language from a sophisticated corporation that is capable of hiring counsel and filing, as we can see, documents and pleadings with the court in English? Are we going to require that court to look at a foreign document, try to figure out what language it's spoken, it's written in, and then locate a translator, incur the expense of translating that document, and then determine what exactly that document purports to be? That's just, I'm thinking about trial courts everywhere in Texas and the kinds of burdens we're going to impose on them. If we come out and say, no, Judge Faustel should have looked at this document, identified what language it was written in, and had it translated, and then made a determination as to what it actually said. My second point is that there is a lag of time here that I think the court should consider. The purported answer, which has actually been affirmatively denied that an answer was filed by a sworn pleading that is in the record, says no answer was filed. But even if it was, I mean, even if they were seeking to attempt to file an answer, why did they wait 2 years until a judgment was finally rendered? There's a certain amount of, what is the obligation we're going to impose on a defendant to affirmatively pursue and say, okay, I'm acknowledging a lawsuit is filed, but I'm going to sit back here for 2 years, make two badly injured plaintiffs wait for 2 years, finally move to get a default judgment, finalize their judgment 2 years later, and now we're going to pull the rug out from under it, because now we're going to take it seriously. The third point is the Lippman case involved a pro se defendant. And I would suggest respectfully to the court that the reason why that defendant was given latitude, and I do believe the defendant said more than just the four, you know, this is the cause number, this is my name, this is the, you know, plaintiff's name. And I believe that the defendant did say more than that, and I feel that the court in that case was willing to give more latitude to a pro se defendant than a sophisticated corporation that can afford counsel. My fourth point is that a motion for new trial filed concurrently with the special appearance would have obviated the need for this restricted appeal. That may be a calculated determination by the defendant. They may not have been able to live with the liability finding because that probably only would have given them a new trial as to damages. And I suspect that's why no motion for new trial was filed. With regard to the jurisdictional matter, I regret that I don't have the benefit of the case that was cited by counsel that specifically references TRAP 30. Most of the law cited by counsel has been with respect to Rule 26, which is not the same as Rule 30. Rule 30, I looked at the plain language of the rule. It says if no post-judgment motion has been filed, then you're entitled to file a restricted appeal. The converse of that is if a post-judgment motion has been filed, then you're not allowed to file a restricted appeal. I looked at the law.
Are there any cases equating the post-judgment motion, that language in Rule 30, with Rules of Civil Procedure 329B, which addresses post-judgment motions that extend the appellate timetable?
I did not see that, and I will tell the court that I honestly thought about, tried to think through the policy implications of this, and I couldn't find cases directly on point. I don't think counsel could either, which is why he keeps going back to Rule 26, which does reference motions that actually extend the deadlines to allow a person to act. Honestly, this is just a plain letter reading of the rule. That's what the rule says. Here's what courts say, that a special appearance is deemed a post-judgment motion that may be considered by a trial court while it still has plenary authority to consider it. And I put the two together and I said, look, it may be that this court does not have jurisdiction. I can't represent to this court that I found affirmative authority that supports that proposition. It's completely a logical inferential argument. Nor could counsel. To his credit, he could not find it either, except I would like to see the case that he cited to the court earlier because I'm interested. Did I answer the court's question? Sorry, I lost
Thank
my place.
You.
With respect to the answer on file, again, I'm going to reference back to the policy argument of what kind of burdens are we going to impose in a trial court? Are we going to require a trial court to scan the record, try to determine what this, document is that's been filed. That's the first one. But I think the more dispositive issue is that there's a sworn verified document before this court in the record, and that's a special appearance that, sworn to by the client, states no general appearance has been made by this corporation, and no answer is on file. I mean, that's a judicial admission right there that I think needs to be considered by the court, especially when there's no evidence in before this court as to what precisely the document was. I mean, if this document had all the quote-unquote Lippman factors, but all it said is, this is terrible, or something completely nonsensical, would that constitute an answer? I don't know. That may be a determination. I mean, we have to think about, or the court has to think about, what kind of burdens we're going to impose on the trial court in within reason. I mean, the trial courts are already burdened enough, and if they have to look and translate documents, figure out what languages they are, that's going to impose quite a burden on the lower courts. With respect to appearance, as I pointed out in the brief, you can't make a corporation cannot appear by an officer of the court. So even if you were to determine that foreign document was somehow an appearance by the defendant, the appellant, it wouldn't be an appearance within the meaning of Texas case law. So, and plus,
we have to say answer.
Pardon?
Are you meaning to say answer instead of appearance?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. So, is it your position then that even for purposes of an answer, a document, an answer, a general denial filed by pro se by an officer of a corporation is not an answer?
No, Your Honor. That's not what I'm saying. I don't think that's supported by case law.
Okay.
And I only address them two separately because they're making the two separate arguments. I'm pretty sure that's the case. So in terms of appearance, they've already affirmatively denied in the record, sworn statement, that this, they made no appearance, affirmatively denied that any answer was ever filed. And to suggest that that has to be in the record before the trial court at the time that the trial court renders default judgment, well, that record was put before the trial court while the trial court still had plenary authority. The whole point of appeals and giving defendants or appellants or plaintiffs the opportunity to appeal is you have all these motions that extend appellate deadlines so that you give a trial court an opportunity to cure its errors. They filed a special appearance, never set it for hearing. They had an opportunity to file a motion for a new trial, never did it. I mean, we have to, I feel like I'm making a big pitch for the trial courts, you know, throughout Texas, but we really do have to think about what kind of burdens we're going to impose on a trial court and how much game playing we're going to let litigants do to avoid having, you know, taking advantage of the procedural tools that are available to them. With respect to the damages, I feel like the 4 points, 1, 2, 3, and 5, are all related to, did we file an answer, and did the trial court err in failing to find that the appellant filed an answer? Or did we make an appearance, and did the trial court err in failing to note that appearance and fail to give us notice? But there's a fourth point, which is the damages issue. And as Mr. Martin correctly pointed out, we did the damages hearing under the original cost number and not the severed cost number. That was error on our part. I racked my brains to think about how to avoid it, and what I did was I have filed a motion, nunc pro tunc, to ask the trial court if it will correct the cause number, because it was with the correct defendants, it was with the same plaintiffs, and evidence of damages was put on before the trial court. And I think the trial court has an interest in being able to correct the record and say, no, look, I actually heard damages. I heard evidence of damages. I didn't just render a judgment against defendant or against appellant without thoroughly reviewing the record and hearing competent evidence. And I think we owe the trial court an opportunity to correct that error and to avoid reversal based on something that did not happen. Something that did happen, but isn't correctly accurately reflected in the record.
May I have a question?
Ms. Canepa, do you have any inkling as to whether or not whoever the person is that filed this not in fact an attorney?
They don't state that they're an attorney. They state that they're a president. They're certainly of a company. They're certainly not licensed in Texas if they are an attorney.
But we don't know. The educational status of whoever the person was that wrote this foreign document.
I'm assuming because they're European, they're very well educated, but I don't think that, I mean, an attorney practicing in Alabama cannot just appear in Texas. They have to file a motion pro hoc vice.
Well, it's equally foreign, someone from Alabama or Poland. Thank you for answering my question.
Yes, Your Honor.
With respect to the burden argument that Ms. Canepa advanced, we're not advocating that there's any burden other than the burden that already exists on a trial court, which is to determine if an answer has been filed. That's an obligation that's pre-existing. All we're asking is that courts be held to that burden.
Have you found any case law dealing with documents purporting to be answers in foreign languages? I know that's unlikely, but every once in a while you find a case, even though it's unlikely. Nothing on that.
I have not, Your Honor. But I would just reiterate what I said before, which is that you don't have to speak a word of Polish to look at the foreign document and understand that it meets the requirement that it is at least an answer. With respect to the argument that it was improper for an officer of the appellant to file the document that somehow renders it a nullity or not an answer. I would point this court to Pagel & Sons versus Gem Ones Corporation, which is cited in our briefing. It's an Austin Court of Appeals decision. And just quoting from that, applying the Supreme Court's decision in Smith versus Lippman, this court has held that the filing of an answer by a non-attorney on behalf of a corporation, while defective, is sufficient to prevent the entry of default judgment. Close quote. And that begins a long section of string cites various courts of appeals throughout Texas. It doesn't matter that it was filed by an officer on behalf of the corporation. With respect to the argument that the Lippman standard should apply differently to pro se defendants as opposed to corporate defendants, with respect to that argument, due process applies to everyone, and it applies to everyone equally. If a pro se defendant is entitled to notice of a trial after making a defective appearance that is nonetheless an answer sufficient to preclude the entry of default judgment, then everyone is entitled to that. Ms. Canepa made reference to this idea that there were suggestions of gamesmanship on behalf of my client filing a document with the trial court and then waiting for 2 years. Well, if you think about it from the perspective of my client, they filed a document with the trial court that they thought at least addressed in some form the lawsuit, and then they heard nothing at all ever again until the default judgment started getting sent to them. They didn't receive notice of the hearing on the partial default judgment. They didn't receive notice of the trial if one in fact occurred. So from their perspective,
about her argument about your statement that no answer had been filed.
Oh, that is a good point, and there are, I think, two responses to that. The first is that, again, that was a document that was prepared and filed within 48 hours after counsel was retained.
Did you withdraw it and tell the judge you didn't mean it?
We did not withdraw it, and we didn't tell the judge we didn't mean it.
Well,
but
since you've got a Polish document and you're telling the judge that's not an answer, isn't it reasonable to expect him to believe you?
That is possible, and there's a clarification that I want to get to, but we didn't effectively have the ability to do it. I mean, we could have done it the following day, but the court lost plenary power, I think, 48 hours after that special appearance was filed. So there wasn't any further action that we could take in the trial court. But there's a distinction here that I think is important, and I will try and articulate it clearly. The Lippman cases and all the other ones that talk about this, they use the term answer to refer to a procedurally defective document that is nonetheless treated as an answer for the purposes of avoiding default judgment. By definition, in those cases, it's not truly an answer. They just use that nomenclature for it. So for an attorney to say, and for the client to verify, no answer has been filed, well, that, in the strictest sense, is true, because what was submitted to the court was a letter from the client that meets the standards for an answer. So I think it is somewhat of a subtle distinction, but an important one. And with respect to the judicial admission argument, which I don't know was raised explicitly in the responsive briefing, it would be one thing if the special appearance said no answer, plea, or pleading, or any other written document sufficient to preclude the entry of default judgment is on file. That's in effect what they're claiming the special appearance said. But that's not what the special appearance said. It makes a general statement that was based on counsel and the client's understanding of the record at that time. And it wasn't until later, this appeal, when more work was done and a better appreciation for the circumstances came up, that we took the position, and it's been a consistent position in this appeal, it hasn't changed once, that the foreign document met the standard for an answer. And on the same point, it is possible, because we don't have a translated version, we can't say what it is, but it's possible that the foreign document could have been some form of jurisdictional challenge, some form of special appearance, in which case the statement in the post-judgment special appearance would still be accurate. But more to the point, again, as I indicated before, the test on a restricted appeal is, does the record reflect, and my time is up, so I'll stop there.
Go ahead, finish.
Does the record reflect, at the time judgment was entered, that judgment was erroneous? And here, and again, the foreign document was available to the trial court at the time it entered partial default and final default judgments, and the error in this case comes from the trial court's erroneous determination that that was not an answer.
I have a question. I'm sorry this time's up. But
No, go ahead.
Mr. Martin, the understanding of most lawyers that I know, when you read Rule 120A, is that it says that you have to file your special appearance before any other document or pleading is filed. So when you're looking at what you believe to be a requirement to file the special appearance before you could get to the other discussions that you had, wasn't it obvious at that point that you couldn't acknowledge that something else had been filed, or you couldn't file the 128?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think this goes back to the fact that that special appearance was prepared under exigent circumstances, and counsel who prepared it may not have had and did not have a full appreciation of what was in the record. And just to finish this thought, if you look just at the docket sheet without the benefit of actually having the record, it doesn't appear that anything has been filed. There's just a foreign document listed. And without knowledge of that, I think counsel for appellant was attempting to do its best job in protecting its client's interest at the time.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. All right, well, we appreciate your argument. Your case is submitted. You're free to go about your business, or if you want to stay and watch the next case, you're welcome to do that. We do appreciate you being here. Thank you. Did the